All right. I've got a group of Canton guys that are here with us. About one-third or more are named Gary. So if you run into someone around camp named Gary this weekend, it's likely that they're from Canton, Oak Point, Canton. It's true. I brought like 10 guys. Three of them are named Gary, and they all rode in the same car together because we're weird like that. But we're really glad to be here. Oak Point, Canton's glad to be here joining Oak Point, West Bloomfield, and Novi. And I'm ready for an awesome weekend, and I hope that you are too. As we watched that video, so he was like, what sport are they playing? I was like, I yelled cricket because for a while I grew up in Australia when I was young. For about 3 or 4 years of my childhood, I was in Australia, which was a really, really great experience. And I played cricket all the time with my brother in the backyard and our neighbors and stuff like that. And one thing that I also liked to do was go away with my friend, a couple of friends actually, to a cabin that one of them had in the woods, which they call the bush in Australia. So we'd go off, drive, it's kind of like going up north. We'd be out in the wilderness. It was a little bit more rustic. And we would hang out there. Now, I don't know how I convinced my parents to let me go with this particular friend, because we would just go with his dad. His dad was actually an American, but he was just checked out, man. He was checked out. And we would go, and we would play with fire. We would cuss, and we would play war. When we were playing war, it wasn't like paintball. We didn't have masks. It wasn't like sneaking up on each other. We played war by filling up our cargo pockets with rocks and sneaking around the woods. And those were our weapons. Like, we would just sneak around with rocks and chuck them at each other. And many times, many, many times, we would get hit either in the crown or the jewels. It happened constantly. And there was one time I had my first ever pimple on the end of my nose. Okay. And I got hit right on the pimple in the nose. It was one of those deep ones, you know? And then after that, my nose, which is already large enough, got even bigger, and that sucker was ready to explode. But we would play war in the woods. And one of the things that was interesting about it was the different tactics we developed. Like, we learned how to like ambush people. We learned how to flank people on either side, because we'd break up into teams, like with six of us, 3-on-3, and we'd find each other out in the woods. It was pretty great. But we learned to be pretty tricky about it, you know? We learn different things. We learn defense tactics as well. One thing that the Bible is clear about in the New Testament is that we as men, we as human beings, we're at war right now. And that's pretty strong language. You know, when we think about history, we think about even current events, which as John said, we need to leave some of that stuff aside. But when we think about those things, like, that's a strong statement to say we're at war, because war is like absolutely destructive. Sometimes it's merciful. You see the face of evil in war. You see all of the worst aspects of humanity come out when a war is taking place, and how we can treat another human being. We can dehumanize another human being to that level. But we are in a war, and our enemies are after us in that kind of way, with that kind of destruction in mind. And the thing about it is, so often as we walk through life as men, we don't even walk with that awareness that there are enemies. We don't walk with an awareness that there is a power out there who's trying to get us. Now, what we're not talking about right now is conspiracy theories. What we're not talking about right now is individual people. We're talking about something completely different as we think about the war that we're in. In fact, in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, we're going to be in James, by the way, for the most part. But in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, Paul's talking, and he tells us that our war is not against flesh and blood, but it's against the rulers and against powers, against the world of forces of darkness, and against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. It's like this spiritual realm is where we are at war. And we actually see a few different enemies come out as we look in the book of James. We're going to look in James chapter 3. We're going to start in verse 13, and it's going to take us into chapter 4 of the book of James tonight as we look at these passages. Now, normally I'm an NIV guy, but there was some wording in the NAS that I could not pass it up, so I dusted off my old NASB Bible and decided to bring that translation along with us for this weekend. So if yours reads a little bit differently, this to kind of track along, it'll be up on the screens as well. James chapter 3, verse 13, who among you is wise and understanding? Now, real quick, James is like a New Testament book of wisdom. If you read James and you read some of Proverbs, you'll see some overlap. You'll also see some overlap with the Sermon on the Mount in the book of James. It's written by a half-brother of Jesus. So he became, I think, after his conversion, which didn't happen until the resurrection of his brother Jesus, I think James became kind of obsessed with his brother's teaching. Like, what did he tell people about? You know, because I missed it. I missed his earthly ministry. What was he teaching? What was he sharing? He probably overheard plenty of it as well, being his brother. So he says, who among you is wise and understanding? He's tapping right into that big theme of his book. And he says, let him show by his good behavior, his deeds, and the gentleness of wisdom. Here's another theme. He's overlapping themes here. Another theme is that faith shows up in action. For James, faith shows up in action. Verse 14, he says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where there is jealousy and selfish ambition, where those exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So this passage is really about a comparison of two types of wisdom. Like, one is true wisdom that comes from God. It comes down from God. The other type of wisdom is something that's not godly. It's demonic, right? He says it's earthly, it's natural, and it's demonic. And that comes at us from the pits of hell. That's the other type of wisdom. And that type of wisdom is actually not wisdom at all, right? That type of wisdom is actually something that's disguising itself as wisdom as we walk through our lives. So really, when we think about this idea that James is getting at with wisdom, it's really about two different ways that he's saying that you can order your life. Biblical wisdom is about ordering your life around the idea that God is going to be the center. He is at the center. Right? Christ be magnified. We're going to lift him up. Everything we do is going to revolve around who he is and who God is, and he's going to be the center of our lives. And then we order our lives around that. That's wise living. That's wise living. And it feeds in to the practical of life, especially as James talks about wisdom. So this really is a comparison of two types of wisdom. One that's wisdom and another that's pretending to be wisdom. And verse 15 reveals for us these three enemies when it comes to living for God. I'm going to read from verse 15 again. It says, this wisdom, this quote-unquote wisdom, is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, or unspiritual, in other words, demonic. It's earthly, it's natural, it's demonic. Those are our three enemies right there. It's earthly, it's of the world. That's what James is saying. This type of wisdom, this lying wisdom, this deceptive wisdom is of the world. And when we think about the world, we think about what the New Testament says about the world, right? And it depends on the context. Because for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. It's not about people. When it says the world in that sense, it's talking about that God loved people so much, he sent his one and only son. But when it says the world like this, when it's a type of wisdom that's worldly, or we're talking about sin and the world, he's talking about a culture. He's talking about something that's going on in the background. He's talking about our society. And really, if you think about our world, this description of wisdom that James gives, this description of something that's about jealousy and selfish ambition that leads to disorder, and leads to evil, every evil thing, right? When we think about that concept of wisdom, that's like our world's wisdom even today, isn't it? Think about what we've sort of grown up on for many of us, the idea of the American dream, right? It's look at what everyone else had. Look at what some people have. You too can have that. Jealousy, right? Selfish ambition. I need to be the one who has the biggest house. You know, I need to drive the fanciest cars. There's all of these things that exist around us. Our world's wisdom says, go and get what can belong to you. Go make that happen. Self-realization, self-actualization, selfish ambition, even jealousy. It sounds a lot like what we're told is a virtue. Sometimes we turn the world's wisdom into a virtue for ourselves. The world is really what's going on around us. It's this culture, it's a society. The second thing he says, it's earthly, it's natural or unspiritual. Another way that the New Testament talks about this is calls it the flesh, the world, and now the flesh. This is that internal battle within us that we are all familiar with, right? This is that internal battle that wages a war within us that we are all familiar with as we walk through lives. Because really the flesh is that other voice in our lives. And Paul talks about it in Romans chapter 7. As we're walking through life, we may desire something at a deep level and we have trouble executing it. In Romans chapter 7, really that's the story of that chapter where Paul is talking about that struggle. He says in verse 21, I find then the principle that evil is present in me, the one who wants to do good. I want to do good, right? 22, for I joyfully concur, I agree with the law of God in the inner man, but I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members. That's the battle against the flesh. That's the flesh. That's the internal struggle that we all have. We have these two natures. Once we've come to Christ, we have two natures living inside of us. We have the flesh. We have the new man. We have the spiritual man who's being redeemed by and transformed by the Holy Spirit. But there's a battle that's still waging on even after our conversion. And we think sometimes I should have had this mastered long ago. Instead, it's owning me. And I still feel like a slave. That's the battle with the flesh. And we know what this is like. We've experienced it. And there's this tendency to find ourselves drawn back in like it's some kind of magnetic force. Drags us back to that group of people, back to that website, back to that place of comfort. Drags us in. James continues on with this third aspect of this wisdom, where it comes from. It's earthly, it's natural, and it's demonic. In other words, it's of the devil. This wisdom is of the devil. Now, the devil's an interesting thing in today's church, you know, especially where we live, because as we consider the devil, as people who are believers in Jesus Christ, if we consider the devil, we have the tendency to do one of two things. We either just wildly over-focus and emphasize the devil as in his role in our lives and even in the world. Sometimes we're fixated. We can't break. Everything's the devil. Or we completely underemphasize the devil. Now, in my experience, in most of the circles where I run, we're usually underemphasizing. We're forgetting, we're ignoring, we're walking around like we don't have an external enemy who's after us. And as we will talk about this weekend, that is absolutely not true. But we feel like it is. You know, we feel like it is. The devil feels like a fairy tale, feels like something that's just so away from where we are right now. And there's an old movie called Usual Suspects, and it says, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist, right? And he did that. He's convinced us. He's got us convinced here in the West that he does not exist. Now, if you go to some other places in the world, spiritual influences and the devil's role is like front and center. And people are not living as ignorantly to that reality, but they see it. But I think part of the reason that we are ignoring and underemphasizing the devil, he likes it. He likes not being detected. I think we'll look at this verse later this weekend, but Peter says he's like our enemy, the devil's like prowling around. He's like a roaring lion waiting for someone to devour. And what is a lion? They wait for an unsuspecting prey. And so that's what our enemy, our adversary, the devil, is doing. He loves to lull us to sleep. He loves to watch us ignore his existence because then we are so vulnerable to his attack. Spiritual evil, again, it's not so front and center here, but it can be front and center in other places. And his movement here is a bit covert. It's under the surface, and we oftentimes ignore it. We see this, the way that he works, and again, we're going to talk more about this over the course of the weekend, but we see the way that he works by telling lies, or in more often than not, twisting truths. We see it from the very beginning. We see it in the garden, the very first sin in Genesis chapter 3. What does the devil do? He approaches Eve. He gets her by herself, and then he says to her something that's partially true. You know, he's like, God surely didn't say you can't eat of any of the fruit in this garden. She's like, oh, no, he didn't say that. He did say something like that, but he didn't say that. And he begins to twist the truth from the start. He says, you're not going to die. You're going to know you're going to have knowledge between good and evil at that point. And that's going to make you like God. And then that starts that temptation. He does the same thing to Jesus when he's out in the wilderness right before he launches his public ministry. The devil approaches him when he's weak, when he's alone. And he starts just poking holes in some things. And one of the ways that he tempts him is by actually bringing scripture into it. He tempts him three times. One of them, he quotes scripture to Jesus. Unfortunately, Jesus was ready with other scripture in order to answer him back in each and every time. The devil, our enemy, is out there and he's real. And sometimes we ignore his existence. Looking back at verse 14, James says something really profound. He says, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, which these are the signs, by the way, bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, these are some of the signs of a false wisdom and of the presence of something, a temptation in our lives that we're falling to when we have those things showing up. He says, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. I thought that sentence was really interesting, and that was kind of at the heart of my reason for picking the NAS to use for this message this weekend, because he's talking about something that's already against the truth. When you say lie, like, oh, somebody lied to me, they've already violated the truth. That's the whole point. That's what the word lie means. And the NAS tends to be, and you can even tell as I'm trying to read it and stumbling over words, it's a little bit wooden in its translation because it just repeats like as much as it can. It sticks to the Greek and the Greek order and everything else. And so sometimes it translates into English a little bit clunky, a little bit hard to read. And for that reason, a lot of times it's great to read other translations as well. But sometimes it picks up on something like in this situation that we would miss in English because in a lot of our English translations, my NIV says something like it denied the truth, which is really the heart of what it's trying to say. But when you read it as woodenly as the NAS brings it across, the emphatic nature of what James is trying to say comes out. Lie against the truth. It's like he's saying the same thing twice. That's emphasis. He's being emphatic with what he's trying to say. When we face things and when we are tempted to lie against the truth, now we're starting to agree with our enemy. We're starting to agree with all three of our enemies. And that's really at the heart of what this battle is against. This battle is against something that is a non-truth. It's against lies. It's against lies. And we'll continue to talk about that this weekend. When we live by the wrong wisdom, we are living many lives in our lives. Here's what John Mark Comer, who's the author of a book called Live No Lies, which some of these concepts are loosely based off of. He gives some sort of a progression that involves our three enemies. He talks about the fact that there are deceptive ideas, which come from the devil, right? Deceptive ideas that come from the devil. These deceptive ideas are those ideas that play to disordered desires. So there's deceptive ideas that play to disordered desires. Those disordered desires are our flesh. That's the old man that lives inside of us, that one that has that battle, that has a magnetic attraction to sin. Deceptive ideas that play to disordered desires that are normalized in a sinful society, which is the world that we live in. Deceptive ideas that play to disordered desires that are normalized in a sinful society. Those are our three enemies, men. As we fight this war, we are at war. As we fight this battle that we are in this world, we're fighting that battle against deceptive ideas that play to disordered desires that are normalized in a sinful society. And we have got to have our guard up or we will get taken out. As James expands on these ideas, we see the type of language that he begins to use, which is similar to what many of the other biblical authors use around the New Testament. In James chapter 4, verse 1, he says, "What is the source of the quarrels and the conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures," right? Your pleasures, your internal self, that battle, the flesh, the pleasures that wage war in your members. That's the source of the quarrels and conflicts. It's the internal, it's the flesh, the pleasures that wage war in your members. And he connects this, I mean, really this idea is connected back even to his own book in James chapter 1, when he points out to us in very clear terms that there is a battle. There is a battle. And that battle involves our own hearts. We're dragged away and enticed by temptation, our own flesh. In James chapter 4, verse 4, continuing on, he says, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God?" Hostility toward God. He ups the ante even more. He says, "Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." You see, in chapter 4, he's going back through these three enemies. He says, those pleasures that wage war in your members, it's the flesh. Then he says, if you want to be a friend of the world, you're going to become an enemy of God. He's using battle language. He's using loyalty language. He's using language of war. We think about the world and we think about a normal war, and there's no option in this case, though, of remaining neutral. We can't be Switzerland. We have to be on one side or another, and we don't want to be enemies of God, right? We don't want to be enemies of God. The world is this culture that's marred by sin. Again, it's not the people. It's the sinful society. And then in verse 7, James says, chapter 4, verse 7, he says, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, interestingly, that idea of the idea of resist, like that has some connection to it that's strong, but really in the Greek, it's a little bit of a stronger word than it comes across even in the NAS. Because as they translated the Old Testament, which was written in Hebrew, they have a Greek version called the Septuagint. And a lot of times we can pick up on the weight of some of the Greek words by looking at how they translated the Old Testament. And this was used as a battle word. This was used about the idea that another king could not resist you, or you're not going to be able to resist this other nation coming against you. It's a battle word. We need to resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So men, as the New Testament, as the Bible shows us pretty consistently, we are at war, and we are at war with these enemies. So what do we do? What do we do? I think the solution that James gives us, and this is not going to stop here, because we're going to keep talking about how we win this battle. But as we look at the solution that James gives us right here in this passage, I think it's really a surprise. Here's how we win the battle. Verse 7. Submit therefore to God. Submit therefore to God. Somehow we win the battle by submitting. We win the battle by submitting, but we submit to God, not our enemy. We resist our enemy, but we submit to God. It says, draw near to God. He will draw near to you. Men, cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. As James talks about these enemies, he calls us to bring that stuff, that junk, to submit it before God, to take it seriously, and to even let it get us down for a little bit. And this weekend's not about getting down, like getting sad. We're gonna get down, but we're gonna lift back up, right? We're gonna lift our eyes to him. But when's the last time, you know, you really had that moment? I was thinking about this before I came up here, because that song, that Christ Be Magnified song, is so powerful. Like, hey, when's the last time, men, that you wept during a worship song? Maybe it was because of the beauty of Christ, the beauty of our God, the depth of the promise. Maybe it was because you were getting in touch with your sin. Maybe it's never happened ever. And for me, that's pretty much the story. It really hadn't happened since the moment I was saved. And then a couple of times this year, God just hit me with something, and it happened like a week or two ago. I didn't even know what was going on. My wife was out of town. I was getting ready to preach to my church, and this song just hit me right in the heart. And I was like, I need someone to hold me. My wife's not even here. I turned around. There's this guy, Alan, at our church. And I was like, you'll do, you know? And I was sobbing, like shoulders, like move, like I was sobbing. I was crying. It felt good, guys. I pray that you have a moment of weeping in worship this weekend. Maybe it's about your sin. Maybe it's about something that you're giving up to God. Maybe it's just his beauty and our brokenness before him. But it causes you to humble yourself. It causes you to humble yourself. And that's really what I want to leave you with, because this is what James says. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord. He will exalt you. Men, the way that we're going to win our battles is to humble ourselves. To realize that left to our own devices, we will not win these battles. But when we humble ourselves before our God, he will give us the victory. He will help us to win. When we don't humble ourselves and we try to take it on our own shoulders, we're just falling back in that same trap the enemy
gave to Adam and Eve at the very beginning, which was, you can be your own God. That same idea. I remember when I was part of CRU, Campus Crusade for Christ at the time, when I was in college, went away on a retreat. I was at Michigan State, went away on a retreat with CRU. And we had this really great speaker that weekend, a guy you might know by the name of Bob Chirac. He came, it was great because that was like my home church. He came and he spoke to our CRU retreat. And they broke out the men and the women on Sunday morning. And Shirley had a session with the ladies, and Bob took the men to another spot on camp. And I remember he said, men, what is the greatest struggle that we face as men in this world? And, you know, a bunch of people shouted out, oh, it's lust. It's like, yeah, that's pretty powerful. Somebody's like, anger. It's a good one too. And somebody says, it's autonomy. It's like, what does that word mean? He was like, man, yeah, that's it. It's autonomy. It's the fight with God for control in our lives. And what it requires for us to let go of autonomy, which when we're fighting for our own control in our lives, we are susceptible to losing the battle to all three of our enemies. When we're fighting that battle for autonomy in our lives, for control over our lives, to be our own God, man, we are in a dangerous, dangerous spot. But when we humble ourselves, we bow before God, he lifts us up. He lifts us up because when we are fighting for control, we're fighting for the position that he rightfully has. Humble yourself. Humble yourself. We're going to reflect a little bit here in just a second. Just on where our hearts are right now, we're going to have time of reflection. I'm going to ask some questions and ask you to respond. But many of us have been humbled. This has been an extremely humbling year for me. Extremely humbling. Some of you know maybe a little bit about my year. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. Some of you may know and not really realize you know, but on January 18th, which is my daughter's birthday, we woke up with a phone call at 3 a.m. And it was my mother-in-law on the other side. My wife had answered the phone. I've never talked about this publicly since the service. My wife answered the phone and she goes, it's my mom, she wants to talk to you. And I was like, oh no. Somehow she just couldn't say it to her daughter, you know. She convinced my wife that it was okay. I just need to talk to Mark. And so I took the phone, I walked out of the room, and she said, Mark, Bob, that's my wife's dad, Bob's dead. I said, oh, Kathy, I'm so sorry. What happened? She said, the house exploded. My father-in-law was up north. My whole family, her sisters, all of the kids had been up north all weekend long. And this was Monday. It was like kind of Monday overnight. He stayed for one more day. And the house exploded. At a moment like that, you know you have no control. You have no control. It's an illusion. All of it is an illusion. That rocked us. It's still rocking us to this moment. We're still quite literally picking up pieces. This whole year, even kind of spiraling out of that and leading up to it and before it, my son is just, he's been just spiraling just in this horrible cycle of deception and of fighting. I can see so clearly his battle for control in his life. He doesn't even see it. All he wants is control. He wants to feel, he feels safe when he's in control. And there's so much other junk related to that. There's a lot of stuff there in the background. I'm not gonna tell my son's whole story. It's his story to tell someday. But he's got some reasons, some really legitimate reasons to have that feeling. But he's fighting a battle for control, and he may not see it, but I can see it so clearly. And I just think about how God's sitting there watching you and he's watching me walk through life, and we don't even know that we're fighting for control and we're fighting for autonomy. And we're trying to do this battle against these enemies alone, and it's being reduced to like behavior management, you know, sin management. And God's saying, no, I've got more for you than that. I've got more, I've got purpose for you. He's saying, put it down. the control that you're fighting for, the autonomy that you're fighting for. Humble yourself and trust in me. Let me exalt you. Stop trying to exalt yourselves. Let's just close our eyes for a moment and ask God some questions. We're gonna ask ourselves some questions before God. Are you open this weekend? Let's talk to God about this. Are you open to exploring whatever God might have for you this weekend? Are you open to exploring whatever God has for you this weekend? Is there anything at all on your heart or in your mind right now that might stop you from submitting to God and drawing near? As James said, is there anything that you need to purify your hearts from, cleanse your hands from this weekend? Something you need to lay down, maybe confess to God, even somebody else, a trusted friend or group? One more question to ask before him. Where have you been pursuing or buying into the world's wisdom instead of that wisdom that comes from God? Help us lay it down. God, we ask you to help us lay it down tonight. Lord, we're broken. We're fighting for our own control. We want to be our own God. Lord, our enemies are feasting on that. God, as we come to you tonight, as we come to you this weekend, would you show us the better way? Your word gives us truth. God, I trust you that when you say it'll be costly, but it will be worth it, that that's what it'll be. God, any part of me that's doubting that right now, would you just wash it away? As we come to you as men this weekend, God, we just ask that you would teach us, that you would have our full attention. God, that we would come to you, that we would draw near to you. That we would wash our hands, that we would purify our hearts. That we would drop the illusion of control and humble ourselves and submit to you. Trust you with it. Pray all this in Jesus' name.